Hello, everyone. I'm Kamran.
And I'm Billy. Welcome to the Horse Frog Podcast, home of your two favorite professional digressors.
Today, we will be discussing Book 3, Chapter 13 of Deadhouse Gates, a novel in the Malazan Book of the Fallen. This is part two of our coverage of this chapter.
This podcast series is intended to be a companion to reading or listening to the books set in the Malazan universe. It's not a book review, and it's most definitely not intended to be a replacement to reading the books. Just know that Kamran and I know that this series is the best fantasy story ever written, and we're approaching this from a purely fanboy point of view. There's not going to be any critique here, just marveling at this book, which is fantastic. We are at a point to marvel in this chapter, by the way.
It's splendid.
Yes, marvelous. Nicely done, sir.
We will be covering the events of the books in a linear fashion. There will be spoilers for those that have not read the books. We'll try not to spoil anything prior to us covering that portion of the respective book.
A quick warning, today's episode contains descriptions of extreme violence, and it's not recommended for children, unless you want to screw those kids up or something.
Our show is listener supported. If you'd like to support us, we'd really appreciate it. You can do so by visiting our Patreon link on our website at horsefrogproductions.com. Currently, we are posting ad-free episodes on Patreon weekly.
Also, we would really like to hear from you, so send any feedback or comments you have to contact@horsefrogproductions.com.
All right, Chapter 13, Part 2. We pick up the chapter with Duiker immediately after he found out the sappers had all disappeared. It was noon before the final positioning was completed. When the Malazan refugees had found out the army would make the river crossing without them, there had been a near riot. Coltane had ordered the Weasel Clan as their escort. They presented a truly terrifying visage with their threaded skin, black tattooing, and filed teeth. The Weasel Riders almost took it too far with their bloodthirsty taunts flung at the very people they were sworn to protect. Calm was established, despite the frenzied, fear-stricken efforts of the Nobleborn's council and their seemingly inexhaustible capacity to deliver protests and writs. Oh, to have been a fly on that wall.
Right? Oh my gosh, these guys.
Duly noted and pissed right. on, as Liz says.
Right.
With the main force finally assembled, Coltane issued the command to move forward. The day was blisteringly hot, the parched ground rising in clouds of dust as soon as the brittle grass was worn away by hooves and tramping boots. Lull's prediction of eating dust proved depressingly accurate. Marching on Duiker's left was Corporal List, his face caked white, helmet sliding down over his sweat-sheened forehead. On Duiker's right side strode the veteran Marine. He did not know her name. Nor would he ask. Duiker's fear of what was to come had spread through him like an infection. His thoughts felt fevered, spinning around in irrational terror of the details that remind one of humanity. He thought, names to faces are like twinned serpents threatening the most painful bite of all. I'll never return to the list of the fallen, because I see now that the unnamed soldier is a gift. The named soldier, dead, melted wax, demands a response among the living. A response no one can make. Names are no comfort. They're a call to answer the unanswerable. Why did she die, not him? Why do the survivors remain anonymous, as if cursed, while the dead are revered? Why do we cling to what we lose while we ignore what we still hold? And that's something worth contemplating. This is where exercises of practicing gratitude can help remind us of recognizing what is truly important in our lives. And I'm not talking about empty platitudes. Getting through the exercise, naming X number of items you're thankful for daily.
I agree.
When I speak of practicing gratitude, I mean, you have to take yourself to the moment where you experience whatever it is that you're grateful for. It's like, how do I feel when I hug my children? How do I feel when I had the strength to accomplish something truly challenging? How did I feel after I recovered from a particularly challenging bout of health issues? Taking yourself back to moments like this will really help drive the concept of gratitude home.
Gee, your inner dialogue universe is so much richer than mine. I'm sorry. I'm just kidding. I don't ever really think that I say this. I don't really think of things like that. I'm supposed to. I know for a fact. As a Christian, we really want to be thankful. We're commanded to be thankful. Most folks I know, this is anecdotal here, but not an indictment as a whole, but anecdotally speaking, Christians are usually kind of glass half empty folks. They're kind of sad folks. I don't know why, but I'm very thankful for everything. I'm like you. I'm just extremely thankful. And we're supposed to, in particular, talk about recovering from health issues. Those are things we're supposed to learn from, because those are usually the times you got time to sit back and reflect. when you get sick, yeah, I think you really should take time to reflect on things like you said. I'm really poor at doing that. When I'm sick and things like that, I kind of just zone out and don't think about much anything.
What I mean by that is I would be very grateful for having gotten over something. When I'm going through a really annoying bout where you can't breathe through your nose is just one example, or you have like a really bad canker sore and everything you eat hurts, and you're like,
I get
you
that.
Know, most of the time I'm not experiencing this, and I don't even think about how grateful I am that I'm not going through this, because it is miserable. Right. You know, you have to breathe through your mouth for 3, 4, 5 days, and you're like, oh my God, when's this going to be over? You know, or like you can't eat or brush your teeth right because you got a canker sore somewhere. You know what I mean? Yeah. It's stuff like that where sometimes it's helpful to just sit there and be like, you know, there was that time I was thinking, man, I wish I didn't feel this way. And it's like, okay, I don't feel that way now. Kind of puts things in perspective. Or I feel a certain way when I hug my kid. Take yourself to that moment. Whatever it is for you, is hugging your pet, whatever it is, if you don't have kids, instead of just listing off, I'm happy my legs work. I'm happy the sky is blue. I'm happy, you know, just like sometimes you get into these ruts where you're like, okay, I need to find 3 things I'm thankful for.
I get it.
What are they?
Right. I'm just generally kind of thankful because, dude, I always approach everything. This is my kind of outlook for the day. Nothing is promised. So waking up on the north side of the grass is something that has not been promised to you today. So I'm always pretty thankful that I'm even here. But that, you know, I just kind of have that general, I think that's why I'm kind of wound like I am a lot of times. I think the world needs occasional guys like me that are pretty oblivious to my own mortality and just are here to enliven everything for everyone else and encourage everyone.
Part of practicing this on a daily basis, though, it primes you to receive better things throughout the day. Because if you're focusing on something positive early in the day, then you see the brighter side of things for the rest of the day. But if you let somebody else control the first thoughts in your head, you go on social media and all you see is negativity, or you go see the news and it's all negative. Right. You're letting someone else control your inner dialogue, or like just priming you to see all the negative in the world.
Yeah.
That's kind of something to think about.
You're right. You're right. I agree.
Moving along. Duerker's thoughts continued. Name none of the fallen, for they stood in our place and stand there still in each moment of our lives. Let my death hold no glory, and let me die forgotten and unknown. Let it not be said that I was one among the dead to accuse the living. I had this quote highlighted, and it's one of those quotes that I have to sit there and digest so I can determine how I feel about it. Because you know there's some import in the quote, but it's like, why do I feel that this is important, and how do I feel about the statement? You know what I mean?
Yeah, I get it. I agree. This has been highlighted since my first read through. I remember talking with you about this, in fact, when we still worked at Fry's. Should we pause here for a moment of silence for the late, great Fry's?
Yeah, we should. Remember the fallen?
Yes. I saw a picture of what Fry's is now in Dallas. It is now like it's an enormous auto parts store. Could you imagine an auto parts store that big?
One you can walk into, or it's a warehouse?
I'm not sure. I would assume it has to be a warehouse.
Okay. Yeah. Because it was basically a warehouse sized building.
Yes. Yeah. I can't imagine the public walking through a store that large looking at parts.
No.
But yeah, that's kind of crazy though.
Yeah. Because it's like an IKEA sized footprint.
Yes. Very much so. Back to Duerker. Yeah, this is something that impacted me really heavy. The first time I read that, I don't know why, but it made me get choked up. Something about this, just how pointless things can be at times and can seem. It's a very, just let me die here forgotten and unknown, because, sorry, given enough time, we're all going to be forgotten and unknown.
Mm-hmm. I can see how Duerker would feel this way, given his duty is observing the events going on, and it would be a terrible toll on him to become friends with all these soldiers only to watch them die and have to be in pain recounting the events that led to their death.
Yeah. In some cases, Duerker seems almost more like a toll taker. I don't mean money, but just dead remembered, that more of that than a historian, just a list taker, a list keeper. It's also the company memory. Technically, he is the memory of the living, I guess. He sees it as a duty, as a heavy duty almost. It's so ingrained in him. He's so driven to remember the stuff. And I know that we've had the reason, the explanation, given his late coming to this and whatnot. I think he feels very obligated to do this and keep track of the dead kind of deal.
is what I'm getting at.
Yeah, thinking about that sentiment of not remembering the names of the fallen, I kind of think about it as like, why live if you aren't going to be close to anyone? When you become close like soldiers do, you aren't going to want to forget someone that sacrificed themselves to save you. You may find you have a duty to their spouse and children that they left behind that you need to help kind of guide the children in their life and remind them what their parent was like and be there for them when they might need you, you know? So I could see both sides of this potentially to toll on the individual because it's painful having somebody that close to you be taken away.
Yeah. I could see that during situations like when you are dealing with it up close, you would need to distance yourself to an extent. Then when you step back a little bit, then you could get close, I guess. I don't know. I don't know. I don't know what the what the way to do it is.
It's a sad way to look at things for Duiker, in my opinion. That's kind of what I'm getting at.
Yeah, I agree.
But he's just kind of putting the wall up, I think. I don't know. He's looking at this in a really dark way.
Protect himself.
Yeah, the more negative side of it.
Am I going to say it or not?
What?
Always with them negative ways, Rory.
The River Paatha bisected a dry lake bed 2,000 paces east to west and over 4,000 north to south. As the vanguard reached the eastern ridge and proceeded down into the basin, Duiker was presented with a panoramic view of what would become the field of battle. Chemist Rello and his army awaited them, the glitter of iron bright in the morning glare, city standards and tribal pennons hanging dull and listless above the sea of peaked helms. The arrayed soldiers rustled and rippled as if tugged by unseen currents. Their numbers were staggering. The river was a thin, narrow strip 600 paces ahead, studded with boulders and lined in thorny brush on both sides. A trader track marked the traditional place of crossing, then wound westward to what had once been a gentle slope to the opposite ridge. But Rello's sappers had been busy. A ramp of sandy earth had been constructed, the natural slope to either side carved away to create a steep, high cliff. To the south of the lakebed was a knotted jumble of arroyos, basaliths, screes, and jagged outcroppings. To the north rose a serrated ridge of hills bone white under the sun. Chemist Rello had made sure there was only one point of exit westward, and at the summit waited his elite forces. I'm going to take a moment to appreciate the description of the land here between the arroyos, basaliths, screes, and jagged outcroppings.
Yes, yes. Yes. I'm not sure what these things are exactly, but I feel like I'm seeing something magnificent here.
Yeah.
Arroyos, I understand.
Well, an arroyo is like a little canyon.
And scree, I kind of know what scree is, but the basaliths, I'm not sure what that is exactly.
Yeah, we need to look that up. Igneous rock.
Yeah, large igneous rock intrusion, not an extrusion. So it must just be something that just kind of sticks there and really, you would, I guess, if you see a basal.
That's a batholith.
Oh, sorry. Sorry, you're correct, sir. That was a batholith. What?
Oh, this is hilarious.
Oh, okay. Videos of basalith.
Okay, so check this out.
Of basalith.
I'm on Reddit looking at this question on R words, okay? And this person is saying, I saw a word in the book this morning. It's not in the Oxford Dictionary nor Google. Batholith does come up. And he says, the book is Dead House Gates by Stephen Erickson.
Oh, is that almost like, do you know what the other one is from Stephen King?
What?
Here's one, was it Prognathus by Stephen King. This is in the Drawing of the Three. It's Prothagonus, is what it's supposed to be. I may be wrong. Maybe it's Prothagonus that is supposed to be Prognathus. But I think King gets it weird.
Okay.
That's when Stephen King did the same thing. He gets it wrong. When you look it up, it does the kind of same kind of thing. And I can't remember what the word is right now, but if you look it up, it goes, Stephen King. It does the, you know, it's Drawing of the Three. There's the problem. It's not a real word, but because King is so well spoken, we assume that it's like, oh, okay, what am I missing here?
You're not. List muttered, Hood's breath. The bastards rebuilt Gellor Ridge. And look to the south, sir. That column of smoke. That was the garrison at Melm. Squinting that way, Duiker saw another feature closer at hand. Set atop a pinnacle looming over the southeast end of the lakebed was a fortress. He asked, who did that belong to? List said, a monastery, according to the only map that showed it. Duiker asked, which ascendant? List shrugged and guessed, probably one of the seven holies. Duerker said, if there's anyone still in there, they'll get quite a view of what's to come.
This is not Pust's monastery, is it?
No, I don't think so.
I didn't think so. I didn't think they were in the same vicinity, but I just wanted to make sure.
Because that's carved into the side of a cliff.
Yeah, that's more hidden, I think. Yeah, okay. Mm-hmm.
Almost Petra-like, but Petra's ground level, I imagined it was something similar where it's carved into the rock, but higher up.
Okay. Yeah, that's kind of how I envisioned it as well.
Camus Rello had positioned forces down and to either side of his elite companies, blocking the north and south ends of the basin. Standards of the Sialk, Halifan, Debral, and Tathanzi contingents rose from the southern element, Ubari the northern. Each of the three forces outnumbered Coltanes by a large margin. A roar began building from the Army of the Apocalypse, along with the rhythmic clash of weapons on shields. The Marines marched toward the crossing in silence. Voices and clangor rolled over them like a wave. The seventh did not falter. And talk about getting butterflies before a performance. Imagine what the Malazans would feel walking into this basin and hearing that.
Wow. First off, just what a scene. But that would be crazy. This is kind of, wasn't this similar? Didn't they cover this in Braveheart? Wasn't this real similar when we first encountered the English?
Yeah, it was a very ominous scene when Longshanks' army was marching up in that first big battle that they had. All the troops when they were coming in. And it just kept coming and coming and coming. In this way, it's a little bit opposite where the Malazans are approaching the huge army, whereas in Braveheart, the small army was already in formation, and then the large army comes to them.
Right.
Duerker thought, God's below. What will come of this? The River Paatha was an ankle-deep trickle of warm water, less than a dozen paces across. Algae covered the pebbles and stones of the bottom. The larger boulders were splashed white with guano. Insects buzzed in the air. The river's cool breath vanished as soon as Duerker stepped onto the opposite bank. Sweat soaked the quilted undergarment beneath his chain hauberk. It ran down in dirty runnels beneath gauntlets and into Duerker's palms. He tightened his grip on the shield strap, his other hand resting on the pommel of his short sword. His mouth was suddenly bone dry, though he resisted the urge to drink from his flask. The air stank of the soldiers he followed, a miasma of sweat and fear. There was a sense of something else as well, a strange melancholy that seemed to accompany the relentless forward motion of the company. Duerker had known that sense before, decades ago. It was not defeat, nor desperation. The sadness arose from whatever lay beyond such visceral reactions, and it felt measured and all too aware. He thought, we go to partake of death. And it is in these moments, before the blades are unsheathed, before blood wets the ground and screams fill the air, that the futility descends upon us all. Without armor, we would all weep, I think. How else to answer the impending promise of incalculable loss? In a dry voice that broke, Lys said, our swords will be well notched this day. In your experience, sir, what's worse, dust or mud? Duerker grunted, dust chokes, dust blinds, but mud slips the world from under your feet. He then thought, and we'll have mud soon enough, when enough blood and bile and piss have soaked the ground, an equal measure of both curses, lad. Mud would be slippery and also stick to everything, weighing you down, and that sounds worse to me.
Yeah, it does to me, too.
Then again, getting sand in your eyes and throat would be rough, too. Could possibly cause pneumono ultramicroscopic silico-volcano-coniosis.
Nice.
Qualifying. I don't know if it would be volcano coniosis, though. Maybe it's something else.
Yeah, it could just be battlefield coniosis.
Battlefield coniosis. Wait, hold on.
Battlefield coniosis.
Hold on a second, Billy. That's a longer word.
It is.
Pneumono ultramicroscopic silico battlefield coniosis.
Oh, that's awesome, dude. Have we just coined one ourselves?
It's the second longest word after the 189,000 character long word.
Right.
Invented here on the Horse Frog podcast.
In front of your very eyes and ears, ladies and gentlemen.
Duerker asked, your first battle then? Lys grimaced, then said, attached to you, sir. I've not been in the thick of things yet. Duerker said, you sound resentful. Lys said nothing, but Duerker understood well enough. Lys' companions had all gone through their first blooding, and that was a threshold both feared and anticipated. Imagination whispered untruths that only experience could shatter. And that's so true, that last line there. Yeah. And it's, again, one of those quotes that Erickson crafts so eloquently.
You know, thanks to Erickson, I think I now understand the meaning of speaks to the human condition. So eloquent there.
Side note, anytime I hear about truths, I'm reminded of the Deep telling that cult leader his truths in season 3 of The Boys.
Oh, yes, it was. It was most assuredly the Deep. And it's one of my most hated phrases, my truth. We discussed that ad nauseum in The Boys. Check it out, folks. Excruciating Details podcast.
I do believe I said you could look at it from the perspective that everybody has what they saw and interpreted from their perspective.
Yes.
That's kind of how I look at it. Because the mind can't be trusted in many cases.
It cannot. It cannot be trusted. Especially with the Deep. Because he is not very, you know, so.
Yeah. Duiker would have preferred a more remote vantage point to observe the coming battle. Marching with the ranks, he could see nothing beyond the press of humanity around him. He thought, why did Coltane put me here? He's taken from me my eyes, damn him. They were 100 paces from the ramp. Horse warriors galloped across the front of the flanking enemy forces, ensuring that all held position. The drumming shields and screams of rage promised blood and would not be held in check for much longer. Duiker thought, then we will be assailed from three sides, and an effort will be made to cut us away from the 7th's infantry while they struggle to defend the wounded. They'll behead the serpent if they can. The Crow horse warriors were readying bows and lances to either side, heads turned and fixed on the enemy positions. A horn announced the command to ready shields, the front line locking while the center and rear lofted theirs overhead. Archers were visible, scrambling into position at the top of the ramp. There was no wind, the motionless air heavy. Here we go.
Mm-hmm.
It may have been disbelief that held the flanking forces back. Coltane had displayed no reaction to the enemy's positions and strength. Indeed, the 7th simply marched on and, reaching the ramp, began the ascent without pause. The slope was soft, boulders and sand, deliberately treacherous underfoot. Soldiers stumbled. Suddenly, arrows filled the sky, sweeping down like rain. Horrendous clattering racketed over Duiker's head as shafts snapped, skidded across the upraised shields, some slipping through to strike armor and helms, some piercing flesh. Voices grunted beneath the turtle's back. Cobbles pitched underfoot, yet the carapace wedge climbed on without pause. Duiker's elbows buckled as an arrow struck his shield a solid blow. Three more rapped down in quick succession, all glancing impacts that then skittered away across other shields. The air beneath the shields grew sour and turgid. Sweat, urine, and a growing anger. An attack that could not be answered was a soldier's nightmare. The determination to reach the crest, where waited howling Semk and Guran heavy infantry, burned like a fever. Duiker knew that the Marines were being driven toward a threshold. The first contact would be explosive. The ramp was banked on either side closer to the ridge, steep and high, its top flattened and broad across. Warriors from a tribe Duiker could not identify, he guessed Can-Eld, had begun assembling on the banks and readying short horn bows. Duiker thought, they'll fire down on us from both sides once we lock with the Semk and Guran. An enfilade. Bolt rode with the flanking Crow horse warriors, and Duiker clearly heard Bolt's bellowing command. In a flash of dust and iron, riders wheeled and swept toward the banks. Arrows flew. The Can-Eld, caught by the swiftness of the Wiccan response, scattered. Bodies fell, tumbling down to the ramp. The Crow warriors rode along the ditch, raking the high bank with murderous missile fire. Within moments, the flat top was cleared of standing tribesmen. So that was the first engagement from the Malazans, none other than Coltane's own Crow clan.
Nice. Love Coltane, man. What a great leader.
A second shout reined in the horse warriors, their lead riders less than a dozen paces from the bristling line of Semk and Guran. The sudden halt drew the wild Semk forward. Throwing axes flew end over end through the intervening space. Arrows darted in return fire. The forward tip of the wedge surged as the Marines saw the disorder in the enemy front line. Crow riders spun their horses, rising high in their saddles as they careered to avoid being pinned between the closing foot soldiers and inadvertently breaking up the Marines' momentum. They pulled clear with moments to spare. The wedge struck. Through the shield, Duiker felt the impact's thunder, a resounding roll that jarred his bones. He could see little from his position apart from the small patch of blue sky directly above the heads of the soldiers, and in that air spun a snapped pike shaft and a helm that might have still held in its strap a bearded jaw before dust rose up in an impenetrable shroud. Duerk heard, "Sir!" A hand tugged at his shield arm. The voice yelled, "You're to turn now!" Duerk thought, "Turn?" He glared at List, who pulled him round. List said, "So you can see, sir." They were standing in the next to last line of the wedge. A space of 10 paces yawned between the Marines and the mounted, arcanely armored, foolish dog horse warriors who stood motionless, heavy swords bared and resting crossways across their saddles. Beyond them, the basin stretched. Duerker's position high on the earthen ramp afforded him a view of the rest of the battle. To the south were closed ranks of Tithanzi archers supported by Dibral cavalry. Legions of Halafin infantry marched east of them to their right, and in their midst a company of Sialk heavy infantry. Further east were more cavalry and archers. Duerker thought, one jaw, and to the north the other, now inexorably snapping shut. He looked to the north. The Ubari legions, at least three, along with Sialk and Tipasi cavalry, were less than 50 paces from contacting the 7th infantry. Among the standards jutting from the Ubari, Duerker saw a flash of gray and black colors. He thought, Marine-trained locals. Now there's irony for you. East of the river, a huge battle was underway, if the vast pall of drifting dust was any indication. The Weasel Clan had found their fight after all. Duerker wondered which of Camist Rello's forces had managed to circle round. He thought, a strike for the herds, and the gift of slaughter among the refugees. Hold fast, weasels. You'll get no relief from the rest of us. Jostling from the soldiers around him brought Duerker's attention back to his immediate surroundings. The clash of weapons and screams from the ridge was growing as the wedge slowly flattened out against an anvil of stiff, disciplined resistance. The first reeling knockback rippled through the press. Duerker thought, Tog's three masks of war. Before the day's done, we'll each of us wear them all. Terror, rage, and pain. We won't take the ridge. A deeper roar sounded in the basin behind them. Duerker twisted around. The jaws had closed. The 7th's hollow box around the wagons of the wounded was crumpling, writhing, like a worm beset by ants. Duerker stared, a wave of dread rising within him, expecting to see that box disintegrate, torn apart by the ferocity assailing it. The 7th resisted, impossible though it seemed to Duerker's mind. On all sides, the enemy reared back as if those jaws had closed on poisonous thorns, and the instinct was to flinch away. There was a pause, a visceral chill that swept the two sides apart, the space between them carpeted with the dead and dying. Then the 7th did the unexpected. In a silence that raised the hair on the Astorian's nape, they rushed forward, the box bulging, distorting into an oval, pikes leveled. Enemy ranks crumbled, melted, suddenly broke. Duerker thought, stop! Too far! Too thin! Stop! The oval stretched, paused, then drew back with a measured precision that was almost sinister, as if the 7th had become some kind of mechanism. Duerker thought, and they'll do it again. Little surprise the next time, but likely just as deadly. Like a lung drawing breath, a rhythm of calm sleep again and again. From my perspective, one of the reasons this battle is so important is us seeing the Malazan military in action for the first time. We've had battles, sure, but never at this scale on a battlefield, and certainly never where they were able to contribute. At Pale, they couldn't do anything but die.
Agreed. You know, we've witnessed the effects of war, not really war itself, per se, in the series so far. Everything we've seen has always been intimate, hand-to-hand, kind of, you know, person versus people, but not like this.
Agreed. And this explosive expansion, then the disciplined contraction of the front line, is one of those images that is a core memory for me.
Agreed. It's for me as well.
Duerker's attention was snared by movement among the foolish dog. Nil and Nether had emerged from the front line on foot, the latter leading a Wiccan mare. The animal's head was high, ears pricked forward. Sweat glistened on its ruddy flanks. The two warlocks halted to either side of the mare, neither leaving the reins to dangle, and laid hands on the beast. A moment later, Duerker was stumbling as the rear lines of the wedge were pulled forward up the ramp, as if carried on an indrawn breath. A nearby sergeant shouted, "Ready close weapons!" Duerker thought, "Oh, Hood's wet dream." That's a new one.
That's a good one, dude. It is indeed a new one. I think that's a top tenner right there. That's a really good one. Is Hood the most invoked swear in this universe? Probably so. It's got to be.
I've seen quite a bit of Tog.
Sure.
Tog and Fanderay.
Yeah.
Do you think?
Well, we'll see them, but I think Hood overall, because he is a generic god of death for everybody. So because he comes for everybody, or they all go to his realm one way or the other, I think it's just one of those things that maybe he probably gets the most colorful and the most volume of curses in his name.
Yeah. It certainly is high.
Oh, yeah.
Beside Duerker, List said, "This is it." His voice was as taut as a bowstring. There was no time for a reply, no time for thought itself, for suddenly they were among the enemy. Duerker caught a flash of the scene before him, a soldier stumbling and cursing, his helm slipped down over his eyes, a sword flying through the air, a shrieking Semk warrior being pulled backward by his braid, his scream cut to a wet gurgle as the point of a short sword burst from under his chest amidst a coiled mass of intestines. A woman marine wheeling from an attack, her own urine splattering the tops of her boots. And everywhere, Tog's three masks and a cacophony of noise, throats making sounds they were never meant to make, blood gushing, people dying everywhere, people dying. A voice shouted, "Where you're right!" Duerker recognized the voice, his nameless marine companion, and pivoted in time to parry a spear blade, his short sword skittering along the tin-sheathed shaft. He stepped in past the thrust and drove his sword point into a Semk woman's face. She sank down in red ruin, but it was Duerker's cry of pain that ripped the air, a savage piercing of his soul. He stumbled back and would have fallen if not for a solid shield thudding against his back. The unnamed woman's voice was close by his ear. She said, "Tonight I'll ride you till you beg, old man." In that baffling twist that was the human mind, Duerker mentally wrapped himself around those words, not in lust, but as a drowning man clings to a mooring pole. He drew a sobbing breath, straightened away from the shield support, stepped forward. Man, I laugh at that line every time.
Absolutely. That always catches me.
Now, his response in latching onto it like a mooring pole, do you think it's because that if that should take place, it would mean that he survived the battle, so there's something afterwards? Do you think that's what's going on there?
Giving himself permission to look forward to something to survive for.
Okay. Ahead battled the front line of Marines, horribly thinned, yielding step after step as the Guren heavy infantry pushed down the slope. The wedge was about to shatter. Semk warriors ranged in the midst of the Marines in wild, frenzied mayhem, and it was these ash-stained warriors that the rear ranks had been driven forward to deal with. The task was quickly done. Brutal discipline more than a match for individual warriors who held no line, offered no support weapon side, and heard no voice except their own manic battle cries. Again, that's a testament to the Malazan military tactics.
Absolutely. Well disciplined.
For all that sudden deliverance, the Marines began to buckle. Three horns sounded in quick, braying succession. The Imperial call to split. Duerker gaped, spun round to look for List, but the corporal was nowhere in sight. He saw his marine companion and staggered over to her. He said, "Four's the withdraw. Were there four blasts? I heard..." She bared her teeth and said, "Three, old man. Split. Now." She pulled away. Baffled, Duerker followed. The slope was treacherous. Blood and bile soaked mud over shifting cobbles. They stumbled with the others this side of the divide, the south, toward the high bank, and descended into the narrow ditch, finding themselves ankle deep in a stream of blood. Man, that's a lot of blood.
It's a lot of blood, dude. That's gnarly.
The Guren heavy infantry had paused, sensing a trap, as they shuffled to close ranks four strides down from the crest. A ram's horn bleated, pulling the formation back to the summit in ragged backstep. Duerker turned in time to see 70 paces farther down the ramp, the foolish dog heavy cavalry edging forward, parting around Nil and Nether, who still stood on either side of the stationary mare, their hands pressed against the animal. The woman at Duerker's side cursed, "Lord's push." That's the bad luck curse, correct?
Yes, that's the push off the cliff.
Not ideal.
That's the way to remember that. That's how we were taught to remember.
Duerker thought, "They mean to charge up this ramp, with its bodies and wreckage and mud and stones, a slope steep enough to force the riders onto their mounts' necks and all that weight onto their forelegs. Coltain means them to charge into the face of heavy infantry. Duerker whispered, "No." Rocks and sand pattered down the bank. Around Duerker, helmed heads turned in sudden alarm. Someone was on the bank's top. More dirt slewed down on them. A stream of Malazan curses sounded from above, then a helmed head peered over the edge. One of the Marines grunted, "It's a hood damn sapper." The dirt-smeared face above them grinned and shouted, "Guess what turtles do in the winter?" Then pulled back and out of sight. Of course they didn't desert. These sappers rising out of the sand is yet another one of those images that's burned in my memory.
Absolutely. Absolute core memory here. And yes, the sappers are too loyal. Where else would these fellas get such nice toys to play with if not in the Malaza military? They can't desert. They need all these wonderful toys.
Yeah. Good point. Duerker glanced back at the foolish dog horse warriors. Their forward motion had ceased, as if suddenly uncertain. The Wiccans had their heads raised, gazes fixed on the tops of the banks to either side. The Guran heavy infantry and surviving Semk stared as well. Through the dust rolling down the ramp from the crest, Duerker squinted toward the north bank. Activity swarmed along it. Sappers, wearing shields on their backs, had begun moving forward, dropping down onto the ramp in the body piled space below the crest. Another horn sounded, and the foolish dog horse warriors rolled forward again, pushing their mounts into a trot, then a clambering canter. But now a company of sappers blocked their path to the ridge. Duerker thought, a turtle burrows come winter. The bastards snuck onto the banks last night, under the very noses of Rello, and buried themselves. What in Hood's name for? The sappers, still wearing their shields on their backs, milled about, preparing weapons and other gear. One step free to wave the foolish dog riders forward. The ramp trembled. The armor-clad horses surged up the steep slope in an explosion of muscle, swifter than Duerker thought possible. Broadswords lifted skyward. In their arcane, bizarre armor, the Wiccans sat their saddles like demonic conjurations above equally nightmarish mounts. The sappers rushed the Guran line. Grenados flew, followed by the rap of explosions and dreadful screams. Every munition left to the sappers arced a path into the press of heavy infantry. Sharpers, burners, flamers. The solid line of Rello's elite soldiers disintegrated. It's amazing the impact that munitions have on the fight. No wonder the Malazans became so successful after adopting them.
Oh, absolutely agree. It's like bringing a gun to a stick fight.
Yeah, it's like the introduction of gunpowder almost. Very similar principle.
Yeah, very much. It's first off, the impact would be unsettling on people who haven't experienced it, like these tribal folks who may know about it but haven't experienced it. Knowing is one thing, experiencing is another thing.
I wonder if that was one of the ways he thought about presenting this, is looking at some society that had gunpowder and when they battled somebody that didn't have it and how that affected the battle.
Yeah, that could very well be.
The foolish dog's galloping charge reached the sappers, who went down beneath the hooves in resounding clangs that beat a dreadful rhythm as horse after horse surged over them, into the gutted, chaotic maelstrom that had moments before been a solid line of heavy infantry. The Wiccan horse warriors cleared the crest and plunged, broadswords swinging down in fearful slaughter. Another signal wailed above the din. The woman at Duerker's side wrapped a gauntleted hand against his chest. She yelled, "Forward, old man!" He took a step, then hesitated. He thought, aye, time for the soldier to go forward. But I'm a historian. I have to see, I have to witness, and to hood with arrow fire. Duerker said, not this time, and turned to scramble his way up the embankment. She shouted, see you tonight, before joining the rest of the Marines as they marched forward. Duerker pulled himself to the top, gaining a mouthful of sand in the bargain. Coughing and gagging, he pushed himself to his feet, then looked around. The bank's flat surface was honeycombed with angled shafts. Cocoons of tent cloth lay half in, half out of some of the man-sized holes. Duerker stared at them a moment longer in disbelief, then swung his attention to the ramp. The Marines' forward momentum had been stalled by the retrieval of the trampled sappers. There were broken bones aplenty, Duerker could see, but the shields, now battered into so much scrap, and their dented helms had for the most part protected the crazed soldiers. What madmen? They volunteered to get run over by horses.
it's like, and you know that there was a bunch of them. They're like, me. They're the first. They wanted to be the first in that bunch. You know that they're that crazy, dude.
That's great. Beyond the crest, on the flatland to the west, the foolish dog horse warriors pursued the routed remnants of Camist Rello's vaunted elites. The commander's own tent, situated on a low hill 100 paces from the crest, was sinking beneath flames and smoke. Duerker suspected that the rebel High Mage had set that fire himself, destroying anything of potential use to Coltane before fleeing through whatever paths his warren offered him. Duerker turned to survey the basin. The battle down there still raged. The seventh ring of defense around the wagons of the wounded remained, though distorted by a concerted, relentless push from the Ubari heavy infantry on the northern side. The wagons themselves were rolling southward. Tipasi and Sialt cavalry harried the rear guard, where the Hisari loyal stood fast and died by the score. Duerker thought, we could lose this one yet. A double blast of horns from the crest commanded the foolish dog's recall. Duerker could see Coltane, his black feather cape gray with dust, sitting astride his charger on the crest. Duerker saw him gesture to his staff, and the recall horn sounded again in quicker succession. Duerker thought, we need you now, but those mounts will be spent. They did the impossible. They charged uphill, with a speed that grew and grew, with a speed like nothing I have ever seen before. He frowned, then spun around. Nil and Nether stood to either side of the lone mare. A light wind was ruffling the beast's mane and tail, but it did not otherwise move. A ripple of unease chilled Duerker. He thought, what have they done? And that's another image I can't forget. The horse frozen still with only the hair moving from the breeze, and yes. Nil and Nether standing there with their hands on its sides still after all that.
Yeah, that's a big deal. That's one, well, because we also know that this is a scene that haunts those two in particular in their memories. So that's
we'll talk about that in a little bit.
Yeah. Yeah. But that haunts me though, because that's one that has always stuck with me though.
The fact that it's just stationary.
Yeah.
You know, it's not alive anymore.
Yeah.
Distant howling caught Duerker's attention. A large mounted force was crossing the river, their standards too distant to identify. Then Duerker spied small, tawny shapes streaming out ahead of the riders. He thought, Wiccan cattle dogs! That's the Weasel Clan. The horse warriors broke into a canter as they cleared the riverbed. The Tipasi and Sialt cavalry were caught completely unawares, first by a wave of ill-tempered dogs that ignored horses to fling themselves at riders, 60 snarling pounds of teeth and muscle dragging soldiers from their saddles, then by the Wiccans themselves, who announced their arrival by launching severed heads through the air before them and raising an eerie, blood-freezing cry a moment before striking the cavalry's flank.
Wow.
Okay, so the dogs are only 60 pounds.
Okay.
The compact descriptor makes sense now. They're more of a meat missile than a hulking beast.
Yes. Yeah. Sounds horrific either way, though. Yes. Between them and the heads raining down around you while this eerie scream is going on, it's like a horror show, dude.
No, thank you. Don't want any part of that.
Yes.
Great. Within a score of heartbeats, the Tipasi and Sialk riders were gone, dead or dying or in full flight. The Weasel Horse Warriors barely paused in reforming before wheeling at a canter to close with the Ubari, the mottle-coated cattle dogs loping alongside them. The enemy broke on both sides, flinching away with a timing that, although instinctive, was precise. Foolish dog riders poured back down the ramp, parting around the warlocks and their motionless horse, then wheeling to the south in pursuit of the fleeing Halafin and Sialk infantry and the Tithanzi archers. Duerker sank to his knees, suddenly overwhelmed. His emotions a cauldron of grief, anger, and horror. He thought, speak not of victory this day. No, do not speak at all. Someone stumbled onto the bank, breath ragged. Footsteps dragged closer, then a gauntleted hand fell heavily on Duerker's shoulder. A voice that Duerker struggled to identify spoke. They mock our nobleborn. Did you know that, old man? They've a name for us in Dibral. You know what it translates into? The chain of dogs. Coltane's chain of dogs. He leads, yet is led. He strains forward, yet is held back. He bears his fangs, yet what nips at his heels, if not those who he is sworn to protect? Ah, there's profundity in such names, don't you think? The voice was Lull's, yet altered. Duerker raised his head and stared into the face of the man crouched beside him. A single blue eye glittered from a ravaged mass of torn flesh. A mace had caught him a solid blow, driving the cheek guard into his face, shattering the cheek, bursting one eye, and tearing away his nose. The horrifying ruin that was Lull's face twisted into something like a grin. He said, "I'm a lucky man, historian. Look, not a single tooth knocked out, not even a wobble." That gallows humor. Hate to see this happen to Lull.
Oh, I know it. I really like Lull. I've come to really enjoy him. But are we sure it's gallows humor? Maybe if he survives, maybe he may not get a new face, but he can enjoy a fine meal at least.
Yeah, I guess it's not technically gallows humor, but you know they do have Denol, so he can probably get healed. But they can't regrow a nose. I don't think.
No, he would still be horrifically scarred, but he's got his teeth. That's a pretty good deal.
Yeah.
It is funny, though.
Talk about seeing the bright side.
Yes.
The count of losses was a numbing litany to war's futility. To Duergar's mind, only Hood himself could smile in triumph. The Weasel Clan had awaited the Tathanzi Lancers and the godling commander who led them. An ambush by Earth Spirits had taken the Semk war leader down, tearing his flesh to pieces in their hunger to rip apart and devour the Semk god's remnant. Then the Weasel Clan had sprung their own trap, and it had held its own horror, for the refugees had been the bait, and hundreds had been killed or wounded in the trap's clinical, cold-blooded execution. The Weasel Clan's war leaders could claim that they had been outnumbered 4-1, that some among those they were sworn to protect had been sacrificed to save the rest. All true, and providing a defensible justification for what they did. Yet the war leader said nothing, and though that silence was met with outrage by the refugees and especially by the Council of Nobles, Duergar saw it in a different light. The Wiccan tribe held voiced reasons and excuses in contempt. They accepted none from others and were derisive of those who tried, and in turn they offered none. Because Duergar suspected, they held those who were sacrificed and their kin in a respect that could not survive something so base and self-serving as its utterance.
Yeah, I'm sorry, there's something here to say real quick. It's almost like anything said by these people, and I see their viewpoint, is almost like it's almost like an excuse, and that in and of itself is insulting.
Yeah, I think that's a pretty interesting way to handle things. Not giving any excuses ever, not voicing them at all.
Yeah.
Would that the world operated that way.
I'm sorry. I'm so reminded of a conversation with a certain friend of ours, certain listener who's a lifelong friend of the show, and about excuses to you as yes and no questions and not an excuse, just a yes or no was all you wanted, sir.
Man, I still encounter this with my kids too.
Because I know my father hates excuses, he just wants an answer. He doesn't care what the answer is. He just wants an answer. I learned that from him right around that time that I was telling our friend this. It's one thing my brother does not do sometimes. He still wants to give reasons. And reasons are excuses. don't ever. Mm-hmm. It's like a reason is a different name for an excuse. So, yeah, my father always hated reasons and or excuses. So I'm just like, yes, no. Even if it's crushing disappointment, I'll still tell him no.
The conversation could progress a lot faster if it was just answered yes or no.
Yes, agreed.
In many cases, when you're dealing with someone like me or your father, when we're asking this question and we're hearing the excuse, it's only making the situation worse.
Oh, yes. Way worse. It's way worse. It's like, just shut up and just move along. Just answer and hush. Don't worry about the – just give the answer. Don't worry about it. Move along.
Yeah. It was unfortunate for them, this being the Wiccans, that the refugees understood none of this, that for them the Wiccan silence was in itself an expression of contempt, a disdain for the lives lost. The Weasel Clan had, however, offered yet another salute to those refugees who had died. With the slaughter of the Tathanzi archers in the basin added to the Weasel Clan's actions, an entire plains tribe had effectively ceased to exist. The Wiccans' retribution had been absolute, nor had they stopped there, for they had found Camus' army arriving late to the battle from the east. The slaughter exacted there was a graphic revelation of the fate of the Tathanzi sought to inflict on the Malazans. This lesson, too, was lost on the refugees. For all that scholars tried, Duergar knew there was no explanation possible for the dark currents of human thought that roiled in the wake of bloodshed. He need only look upon his own reaction when stumbling down to where Nil and Nether stood, their hands gummed with congealing sweat and blood on the flanks of a mare standing dead. Life forces were powerful, almost beyond comprehension, and the sacrifice of one animal to gift close to 5,000 others with appalling strength and force of will was on the face of it worthy and noble. Duerker thought, if not for a dumb beast's incomprehension at its own destruction beneath the loving hands of two heartbroken children. The revelation that they sacrificed the life force of this horse to power that charge is a truly heartbreaking turn of events.
Yes.
You know, I always get kind of teary-eyed thinking about it. These people effectively worship the horses, and for them to resort to this speaks volumes of the desperation they must be in at this point.
Terrible desperation. I'm like you. It's such a heartbreaking thing for us. And in particular, on this read through with you, where you and I have both taken love to several horses in this book, the loss of one like this is more emotional because of that, I believe, because of this love for these other horses in this book.
Yeah. The visual that I have of this in my head, it's so crazy. It's like white horse. As they stood there with their hands on it, I could imagine the vascular system turning black as they suck the life from it. And it's just standing there and it's like a husk of an animal.
Yeah.
And their hands are permanently stained black with the act that they've done.
Yeah.
The toll that would have on you. It's just unbelievable. It's really just a powerful image, the sacrifice.
Yeah, agreed.
And what a power from a life force.
From one, just the one life force. It's fascinating that I say fascinating. It's we talk about core memories in this book. This chapter alone has held almost more core memories than the entirety of the series so far. In the from Gardens on, there's so many in this particular battle alone. There's so many battles going on individually at this. You know, each one of these battles could be watched from a movie standpoint for 10 minutes alone. And I'm blown away by the scale of this. But this horse standing there, just stock still with the hair moving. And like you say, the veins going black and other things, but just the hair and the hair, that's it. That's a very unsettling and a really, I can see that it's a powerful visual.
All right, for standout moments, seeing the Malazan forces in action and being described in detail for the first time, really impactful to me.
Yeah, I agree with you. This is really cool seeing this because I forget that this is truly the first big battle we witness. I mean, Pale is a big battle, but it's not because you see these huge forces arrayed and then summarily wiped out just like by a fist of God almost. It's like, boop, and there you go. And that's all she wrote. This is a protracted engagement. This is the first one of these we've really seen. And it's, let's just give it up for Mr. Erickson on his military drama here. This is exciting stuff.
It is. And I'd like to point out that think about how undermanned the Malazans are here. This wedge that went up this hill was a very small amount of Malazan Marines.
Yes.
Undermanned bunch of sappers with limited munitions. Okay.
Yes.
Think about if this was a full army, fully stocked and provisioned. Nothing could compare to them.
Nothing could have stood to that. If they had gone there with Coltane under Dujek, with our guys and the Bridge Burners and another great army backing them up, dude, please, these people would stand no chance. This would not be a problem walking these nobles from city to city. It'd be a nice walking tour for them.
Yeah.
You know, it'd be like when you see those old images of people rolling up to the battlefields in their carriages and their nice threads, trying to watch the battle. That's kind of what it would be like. And that's what it's trying to be like here. But with the right army here, this would be no problem.
Mm-hmm. So you're envisioning it's like Marcus Aurelius rolling up on Gladiator at the beginning.
Yeah, now that you mention it, yes.
Speaking of Roman type action, the explosion outward of the Malazan forces and the disciplined contraction back to the line. Very Romanesque.
Yes, and very impressive. And I agree. It's just awesome.
The female veteran bolstering and motivating Duerker to move forward.
Agreed.
Gets me every time.
It does. She's, well, you know what? In this bleak and heavy scene, she's kind of a slight ray of light, a little ray of sunshine there for a moment.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sorry. I'm thinking of Butters and Kissing Company. Go ahead, please.
Oh.
A little stormy cloud for you. You get a sunshine. It's like...
Yeah, speaking of positive moments, the sappers reappearing and their impact on the battle.
Oh, what a great scene.
The way they reappeared, and then one throws a joke down at them. He's like, what do the turtles do in the winter, you know?
Yeah, what a great scene. I mean, them coming out of the mud and revealing that they themselves are going to be the solid footing for the army. What a great morale boost here. What a great scene.
What a great scene. The visuals of them. Imagine a slow-mo shot of these people just emerging from the dirt. The dirt's kind of streaming down around them. And then you figure out who they are. Oh, man. Turn the tide of battle.
If this was a movie, the crowd would erupt into applause here when you see the sappers coming up out of the ground.
Dude, I'll tell you what, Billy. I got this entire battle. I have it scene for scene. The shots planned out. The music selected. All of it in my head. Already. I've been thinking about this for years. Yeah, dude. You think I'm playing around when I say when I get $1 billion, I'm going to talk to Mr. Erickson. I'm like, Mr. Erickson, I have a proposal for you. Okay. I would like to bring this to the world. It's going to be the greatest series for television ever produced.
Yes. It will be.
No changes. Exactly as you envisioned it.
None. None made for
ease of
the audience.
Here's who we have cast. Here's who we'd like to cast. Show them our website.
Can we use likenesses of dead people too?
That's an interesting thing. Kind of tough topic right now, because think about what they did in Rogue One when they brought Grand Moff Tarkin back.
Oh, my word. I'm such a huge Peter Cushing fan. Peter Cushing and Christopher Lee, they were together in several horror movies for Hammer Studios back in the 60s and 50s. They did some 20, 30, 40 movies together. I forget how many. And so I'm a huge Cushing fan. And so to have him come back from the dead was like, oh my gosh, that's Cushing. I'm going to love it. I just loved it, dude. And they even did Carrie Fisher younger in that too. I can't remember if she was already dead at that point or not. I don't think she was dead. They just de-aged her, didn't they? Or was she dead at that point? I can't remember.
I think they might have done a digital replacement.
Okay.
Yeah, I think she was just at the very end of it when her ship gets boarded, right? And they show R2-D2 and C-3PO going down to Tatooine. Either way, digression. I have this whole battle in my head planned out, storyboarded, the whole thing.
Okay.
All the visuals are there. It's magnificent.
It sounds magnificent.
Maybe this AI stuff gets to a point where it could do some animations automatically without too much trouble. I might start.
You might be able to. I'll tell you, you could very well. I've seen some of there's a Christian YouTuber I like that told an AI program to make him a fake Joel Osteen commercial. And dude, it didn't have animation, but it had audio. And it was amazing, dude. It was really biting too. It was really quite biting. Really quite biting.
Let's not go into Joel Osteen right now. We're going to start getting into money being hidden in the walls and the church and all that kind of stuff.
Could be your thing. Maybe you could direct the first AI movie of all time. Wholly directed by AI and you.
Oh, wow. All right. Well. We'll see how things progress.
Right.
All right, moving along. The sacrifice of the horse's life force to allow that charge up the hill.
Yeah.
Heavy stuff right there.
Super heavy, and it's always stuck with me. And I already kind of covered it, but I think, like, real quickly, though, but just you and me talking so much and developing such a love for several horses in this book, in particular, makes this a little more felt, more poignant.
Yeah. The charge up the hill itself, including going over a road of sapper backs.
Mm, wow. Just wow. That's all I got. Wow. You're right.
Yeah. And then the entire battle, this entire segment, it's one of my favorite segments in the book, in the whole Malazan Book of the Fallen, even. I keep coming back to this battle. I don't want to take away from other parts of this book because I love this book. There's some other really, really cool stuff coming up, but this battle in particular has always left just a big impression on me.
I agree. Do you think it's left an impression on you mostly because of the superiority of Coltane's force, even though he's so undermanned, comparatively speaking, and he does so much with so little, versus what we know later on happens? There are some major conflicts that are big, if not bigger, but it's kind of uniformly matched, a little more evenly matched as far as forces versus these guys are so outnumbered and on the run. Is that what makes this so much more powerful?
I think it's a combination of things. Number one, some of the stuff we already talked about. The first time we're seeing the Malazan forces in action, you can't help but have your jaw drop thinking mm-hmm. about how effective they are. But then beyond that, it's a moment of positivity. Even though they took heavy losses, they won. And yes. It feels like for all the trouble they've been having, they might be able to do it.
I know it. I always think they're going to do it too.
So that's my perspective. How about you? What do you think?
Yes. I always think they're going to do it. They're going to do it as far mm-hmm. as I'm concerned.
Yeah.
And everything about this is just, I agree with everything. First conflict, the impressiveness of yet another amazing feat pulled off by Coltain. I mean, he keeps pulling these out. And again, what are we, week, month five or so on the road for these guys? They're at almost half a year at this point.
Yeah, crazy.
That's brutal.
How are you going to have enough food for 6 months? They bought that much cattle for how many, 40,000 people?
Well, that or they can just eat all the folks.
That's a lot of food, man.
Hey, folks are, I don't know. I mean, I guess I know people don't want to be eating people. I'm not a big fan of the idea, but I mean, there's a lot of folks to be fed and there's a lot of folks on the ground to be fed to people, I guess. So,
oh, man. This reminds me of something I got to tell you. You're going to appreciate this. Okay. This game just came out. It's called Pal World. Okay.
Okay.
It took inspiration from Pokemon, but there's guns in it, but they have creatures like Pokemon in there. Okay. I saw an article about it this morning. You mentioning butchering people, eating people reminded me of this. So in this game, you can capture the creatures and you can butcher them and sell their parts. Okay. Well, somebody captured another human player and was able to butcher the human player and sell their parts for a hefty profit.
Okay. That's pretty dark.
I don't know if they intended for this to be in the game. Maybe it's a bug. Maybe you're not supposed to be able to target other people. But the fact that it functionally works is hilarious.
That is hilarious. And like I said, that goes even darker than me hog tying and feeding someone to a gator in Red Dead 2.
Hold on a second. Was that the feminist? Did you do that? Or was that somebody else?
No, that was somebody else. No, that was not me. But I know what you're talking about.
I know
what you're talking about. I was told that you could do this, so I just got some guy that annoyed me. Because there's a couple of trophies to be had. There was no trophy for this one. But you get a trophy for dragging somebody like 1,000 yards. But you can't go too fast. You get it because you'll kill them. So you got to kind of just trot. You got to kind of trot the horse, and it's about a 5 or 10 minute deal. But it's kind of funny because the guy's cussing at you the whole time. You can cut him loose if you want, and then kill him. It's Red Dead. I always cut him loose and kill him. But I was told that you could feed someone to a gator, and I said, "Oh, so I just hogtied. I did what they told me. I just grabbed some random passerby." It wasn't the feminist. It was just somebody that was out in the swamps, and I saw a couple folks over by this house, and I just went over there and drove over there. It all tied him and drug this poor soul out in the middle of the swamp and fed him to a gator.
Man, I must have read an article about that. Some streamer took the suffragettes that are in the.
Yes. I heard about that just this week. It's just this week I've heard about this. That's what's so funny. I had never heard about that till now. I'm like, that's too funny. I love it.
Oh, man.
Oh, that's good. Great minds. Yeah, it is.
All right, Billy.
It is ridiculous.
You got any final thoughts before we drop off here?
It's just wow. What a great episode and what a great chapter so far. Just absolutely amazing.
Yeah. Great job tonight.
Really good episode, man. Good job yourself.
Thank you. All right. Thanks, everybody. We'll see you next week.
See y'all next week.
We thank you all for joining us today.
Again, we'd really like to thank you for taking the time to be with us, and we've had a really great time talking about the topic today.
If you would like to support our show, you can find us at horsefrogproductions.com, where you can find our Patreon link. Depending on the platform you're listening from, it may also be in the episode description.
And if you'd like to contact us through email, it's at contact@horsefrogproductions.com.